They were all at Charing Cross to see Lilia off. Philip, Harriet, Irma, Mrs. Herriton herself, even Mrs. Theobald, squired by Mr. Kingcroft, had braved the journey from Yorkshire to bid her only daughter goodbye. Miss Abbott was likewise attended by numerous relatives, and the sight of so many people talking at once and saying such different things caused Lilia, sprawling out of her first-class carriage, to break into ungovernable peals of laughter.
Quite an ovation. They'll take us for royalty. Oh, Mr. Kingcroft, get us foot warmers. Oh,
righto.
The good-natured young Mr. Kingcroft hurried away, and Philip, taking his place, flooded Lilia with a final stream of advice and injunctions. Where to stop, how to learn Italian, when to use mosquito nets, what pictures to look at.
Remember to see the little towns. Gubbio, Pienza, Cortona, San Gimignano, Monteriano, and don't I beg you go with that awful tourist idea that Italy is only a museum of antiquities and art. The people are more marvellous than the land.
Oh, how I wish you were coming, Philip.
I wish I were.
Philip could have managed it without great difficulty, for his career at the bar was not so intense as to prevent occasional holidays. But his family disliked his continual visits to the continent, and he himself often found pleasure in the idea that he was too busy to leave town.
Goodbye, dear everyone. What a whirl! Oh, Irma. Goodbye, darling. And mind you're always good and do what Granny tells you.
Lilia referred not to her own mother, but to her mother-in-law, Mrs. Herriton, who hated the title of Granny.
She is sure to be good,
said Mrs. Herriton, who was standing pensively a little out of the hubbub. But Lilia was already calling to Miss Abbott, a tall, grave, rather nice-looking young lady, who was conducting her adieus in a more decorous manner on the platform.
Caroline, my Caroline! Jump in or your chaperone will go off without you!
And Philip, whom the idea of Italy always intoxicated, had started again, telling her of the supreme moments of her journey.
And the Campanile of Airola, which will burst on you when you emerge from the St. Gotthard Tunnel.
Handkerchiefs and collars.
The view of Lugano.
In my inlaid box.
The view
box.
Of Como.
I've lent you my inlaid box.
Good old Harry.
Do take care of it, Lilia. It is very precious.
Said Harriet, Mrs. Herriton's elderly daughter, of whom her brother Philip once said she had bolted all the cardinal virtues and couldn't digest them. They waved their handkerchiefs and uttered cheerful little cries. The train moved, and at that moment Mr. Kingcroft reappeared, carrying a foot warmer by both ends, as if it was a tea tray.
Goodbye, Mrs. Charles. May you enjoy yourself and may God bless you.
Oh, I'm sorry, but you do look so funny. Oh, you all look so funny waving.
And laughing helplessly, she was carried out into the fog.
Bon voyage!
Rather hastily, Mrs. Herriton shook hands and left Mr. Kingcroft to take Mrs. Theobald all the way back to Whitby. Sawston, her own home, was within easy reach of London, and they were not late for tea. Tea was in the dining room, with an egg for Irma to keep up the child's spirits. The house seemed strangely quiet after a fortnight's bustle, and the conversation was spasmodic and subdued. They wondered whether the travellers had got to Folkestone, whether it would be at all rough, and if so, what would happen to poor Miss Abbott.
Granny, when will your ship get to Italy?
Asked Irma.
Grandmother, dear, not Granny. And Mother won't go all the way by sea. You look at the map of Europe and you'll see why. Harriet, take her. Go with Aunt Harriet and she'll show you the map.
Righto,
said the little girl and dragged the reluctant Harriet into the library.
Here beginneth the new life.
Oh, poor child, how vulgar. It's surprising that she isn't worse. But she has got the look of poor Charles about her.
And alas, alas, a look of old Mrs. Theobald.
It was now nearly 10 years since Charles had fallen in love with Lilia Theobald because she was pretty. And during that time, Mrs. Herriton had hardly known a moment's rest. For 6 months she had schemed to prevent the match. And when it had taken place, she turned to another task, the supervision of her daughter-in-law. Lilia must be pushed through life without bringing discredit on the family into which she had married. The birth of Irma made things still more difficult. But fortunately, old Mrs. Theobald, who had attempted interference, began to break up. It was an effort for her to leave Whitby, and Mrs. Herriton discouraged the effort as far as possible. Charles died. A house was taken for Lilia at Sawston, and there for 3 years she lived with Irma, continually subject to the refining influences of her late husband's family. During one of her rare Yorkshire visits, trouble began again. Lilia confided to a friend that she liked a Mr. Kingcroft extremely, but that she was not actually engaged to him. The news came round to Mrs. Herriton. She took the opportunity of speaking more seriously about the duties of widowhood and motherhood than she had ever done before. But somehow things never went easily after. Lilia would not settle down in her place among the Sawston matrons. She was a bad housekeeper, always in the throes of some domestic crisis, which Mrs. Herriton, who kept her servants for years, had to step across and adjust. She learned to bicycle, for the purpose of waking the place up, and coasted down the high street one Sunday evening, falling off at the turn by the church. If she had not been a relative, it would have been entertaining, but even Philip, who in theory loved outraging English conventions, rose to the occasion and gave her a talking which she remembered to her dying day. It was just then, too, that they discovered that she still allowed Mr. Kingcroft to write to her as a gentleman friend, and to send presents to Irma. It was Philip, the clever one of the family, who had thought of Italy, and the situation was saved. Caroline, charming, sober Caroline Abbott, who lived two turnings away, was seeking a companion for a year's travel.
It is mortifying to think that a widow of 33 requires a girl 10 years younger to look after her.
I pity Miss Abbott. Still, I do believe that Italy really purifies and ennobles all who visit her. She is the school as well as the playground of the world. It is really to Lilia's credit that she wants to go there.
I find the situation quite full of whimsical romance.
Mrs. Herriton did not believe in romance. She adroitly changed the subject before Philip got excited. Soon Harriet returned, and the two ladies played cards. Philip read a book. And so they all settled down to their quiet, profitable existence, and continued it without interruption through the winter. Lilia wrote frequently. Florence she found perfectly sweet, Naples a dream, but very withy. In Rome, one had simply to sit still and feel. Philip was particularly gratified when in the early spring she began to visit the smaller towns that he had recommended.
Monteriana? They've stopped there over a week. Why? I shouldn't have done so much myself. They must be really keen, for the hotel's none too comfortable.
But what can Lilia be doing there all day? And there's no church there, I suppose.
There is Santa Deodata, one of the most beautiful churches in Italy.
Of course I mean an English church.
Harriet was curiously virulent about Italy, which she had never visited, her only experience of the continent being an occasional 6 weeks in the Protestant parts of Switzerland. Ignoring her, Mrs. Herriton sat a little longer at the breakfast table, rereading Lilia's letter. Then, the weather being lovely, and Philip gone to the station and Irma to school, she and Harriet went to the kitchen garden to sow some early vegetables. The peas were saved to the last, for they were the greatest fun. Righteous fatigue stole over them as Harriet stretched a string to guide the rows straight, and Mrs. Herriton scratched a furrow with a pointed stick. At the end of it, she looked at her watch.
It's 12. The second post's in. Run and see if there are any letters.
Let's finish the peas. There won't be any letters.
No, dear, please go. I'll sow the peas, but you shall cover them up. And mind the birds don't see them.
Mrs. Herriton was very careful to let those peas trickle evenly from her hand, and at the end of the row she was conscious that she had never sown better.
Actually, one from old Mrs. Theobald.
Oh, read me the letter. My hands are dirty.
How intolerable the crested paper is.
I don't understand. It doesn't make sense.
Her letters never did.
But it must be sillier than usual. Look here. Read it, Mother. I can't make head or tail.
What is the difficulty? What is it that puzzles you in this letter?
The meaning.
The meaning is quite clear.
Lilia is engaged to be married.
Oh.
Don't cry, dear. Please me by not crying. Don't talk at all. It's more than I could bear. She is going to marry someone she has met in an hotel. How dare she not tell me direct? How dare she write first to Yorkshire?
Oh, what is to be done? What is to be done?
This first. Next, a telegram for Lilia. No, for Miss Caroline Abbott. Wire reason of stay at Monteriano. Strange rumours.
Someone in an hotel.
Philip is back at 7, and the 8:15 catches the midnight boat at Dover. Harriet, when you go with a telegram, get £100 in £5 notes at the bank.
But why? What?
And get down his Gladstone from the attic.
So Philip was received with the news that he must start in half an hour for Monteriano. In the flush of departure, the doorbell rang, and there was the telegram. Lilia engaged to Italian nobility, writing Abbott. Mrs. Herriton would not allow herself to be frightened by the unknown. Indeed, she knew a little now. The man was not an Italian noble, otherwise the telegram would have said so. It must have been written by Lilia. None but she would have been guilty of the fatuous vulgarity of Italian nobility.
The man may be a duke, or he may be an organ grinder. That is not the point. If Lilia marries him, she insults the memory of Charles, she insults Irma, she insults us. Therefore, I forbid her. And if she disobeys, we have done with her forever.
I will do all I can.
It was the first time Philip had had anything to do. He kissed his mother and sister and puzzled Irma. The hall was warm and attractive as he looked back into it from the cold March night, and he departed for Italy reluctantly, as for something commonplace and dull. Just as she was going upstairs, Mrs. Herriton remembered that she had never covered up those peas. It upset her more than anything, and again she struck the banisters with vexation. Late as it was, she got a lantern from the tool shed and went down the garden to rake the earth over them. The sparrows had taken every one, but countless fragments of the letter remained, disfiguring the tidy ground. When the bewildered tourist alights at the station of Monteriano, he finds himself in the middle of the country. Of the town, medieval or otherwise, there is not the slightest sign. He must take what is suitably termed a legno, a piece of wood, and drive up 8 miles of excellent road into the Middle Ages. It was 3 in the afternoon. Miss Abbott, who had just received Philip's letter from Milan announcing the time of his arrival, had hurried down to meet him. He had known Miss Abbott for years, and had never had much opinion about her one way or the other. She was good, quiet, dull, and amiable, and young only because she was 23. The silence was prolonged. For 3 days he had been considering what he should do, and still more what he should say. He had invented a dozen imaginary conversations, in all of which his logic and eloquence procured him certain victory. But how to begin? He was in the enemy's country, and everything, the hot sun, the endless rows of olives, regular yet mysterious, seemed hostile to the placid atmosphere of Sawston in which his thoughts took birth.
Are we to talk over it now?
Certainly, please.
if you will be so very kind.
Then how long has she been engaged?
Exactly 11 days.
Well, how long have you been here?
Close on 3 weeks.
Well, who is he?
A native of the place.
The second silence took place.
I understood that they met at the hotel.
It was a mistake of Mrs. Theobald.
I also understand that he is a member of the Italian nobility. May I be told his name?
Carella.
Carella? Conte or Marchese or what?
Signor.
How old is Signor Carella?
Oh, quite young. 21, I believe.
Good Lord.
He looks much older.
Well, and is he good looking?
Very good looking. Though I dare say English standards would find him too short.
May I conclude that you like him?
As far as I have seen him, I do.
At that moment, the carriage entered a little wood. The trees were small and leafless, but noticeable for this, that their stems stood in violets, as rocks stand in the summer sea. Philip paid no attention at the time. He was thinking what to say next. But his eyes had registered the beauty, and next March he did not forget that the road to Monteriano must traverse innumerable flowers.
What is he, please? You haven't told me that. What's his position?
No position at all. He is kicking his heels, as my father would say. You see, he has only just finished his military service.
As a private?
I suppose so. There is general conscription.
Meanwhile?
Meanwhile, like most young men, he lives with his people.
One more question, and only one more. What is his father?
His father? Well, I don't suppose you'll think it a good match. I mean, the point is not... I mean that social differences are... But I feel that you and at all events your mother, so really good in every sense. After all, marriages are made in heaven.
Yes, Miss Abbott, I know. But I am anxious to hear heaven's choice. Is my sister-in-law to marry an angel?
Mr. Harrington, don't, please. A dentist. His father is a dentist.
A dentist?
A dentist at Monteriano. A dentist in Fairyland. The town above them swung to the left, to the right, to the left again, as the road wound upward through the trees and the towers began to glow in the descending sun. They emerged onto the terrace with a vision of half Tuscany radiant behind them, and then they turned in through the Siena gate. Their journey was over.
Silenzio! Sono pregati di fare un po' di silenzio!
Philip was stunned and knew not what to do. At the hotel, he received no ordinary reception. The landlady wrung him by the hand. One person snatched his umbrella, another his bag. The entrance seemed blocked with a crowd. Dogs were barking, bladder whistles being blown, women waving their handkerchiefs, excited children screaming on the stairs. And at the top of the stairs was Lilia herself, very radiant, with her best blouse on.
Welcome! Welcome to Monteriano! You told me to come here, and I don't forget it. Let me introduce you to Signor Carella.
Philip discerned behind her a young man who might eventually prove handsome and well-made, but certainly did not seem so then.
Well, Din-Din's nearly ready. Your room's down the passage.
Philip stumbled away to wash his hands.
Oh, dear Caroline, what an angel you've been to tell him. He takes it so well. But you must have had a mauvais quart d'heure.
I've told nothing. It's all for you, and if it only takes a quarter of an hour, you'll be lucky.
Dinner was a nightmare. They had the smelly dining room to themselves. Lilia, very smart and vociferous, was at the head of the table. Miss Abbott, also in her best, sat by Philip, looking to his irritated nerves, more like the tragedy confidant every moment. Signor Carella sat opposite. Behind him loomed a bowl of goldfish, who swam round and round, gaping at the guests. The face of Signor Carella was twitching too much for Philip to study it. But he could see the hands, which were not particularly clean, and did not get any cleaner by fidgeting amongst the shining slabs of hair. His starched cuffs were not clean either, and as for his suit, It had obviously been bought for the occasion as something really English, a gigantic cheque which did not even fit. Altogether, he was quite unpresentable, and very lucky to have a father who was a dentist in Monteriano. And why even Lilia? But as soon as the meal began, it furnished Philip with an explanation. For the youth was hungry, and his lady filled his plate with spaghetti, and when those delicious, slippery worms were flying down his throat, his face relaxed and became for a moment unconscious and calm. And Philip had seen that face before in Italy 100 times, seen it and loved it, for it was not merely beautiful, but had the charm which is the rightful heritage of all who are born on that soil. But he did not want to see it opposite him at dinner. It was not the face of a gentleman. Lilia talked bravely till the end of the disgusting meal, and then rose.
Well, Philip, I'm sure you're ready for bye-bye. We shall meet at 12 o'clock lunch tomorrow, if we don't meet before. They give us cafe latte in our rooms.
I should like to see you now, please, in my room, as I have come all the way on business.
It was as he expected. When he was alone with Lilia, he lost all nervousness. The remembrance of his long intellectual supremacy strengthened him, and he began volubly.
My dear Lilia, don't let's have a scene. Miss Abbott has told me a certain amount, and the rest I see for myself.
See for yourself?
That he is probably a ruffian and certainly a cad, and he's the son of a dentist.
Indeed, Philip, you surprise me. I understood you went in for equality and so on.
And I understood that Signor Corella was a member of the Italian nobility.
We put it like that in the telegram so as not to shock dear Mrs. Herriton. But I think what people are is what matters. But I don't suppose you'll agree.
Lilia, he has taken you in. I am not blaming you now, but I blame the glamour of Italy. I have felt it myself, you know, and I greatly blame Miss Abbott.
What's all this to do with Caroline?
So I am confident, and you in your heart agree, that this engagement will not last. Think of your life at home. Think of Irma. And I'll also say, think of us. For you know, Lilia, that we count you more than a relation. I should feel I was losing my own sister if you did this, and my mother would lose a daughter.
I can't break it off now.
Oh, poor Lilia. I know it may be painful, but I have come to rescue you. And bookworm though I may be, I am not frightened to stand up to a bully. He's merely an insolent boy. He thinks he can keep you to your word by threats. He will be different when he sees he has a man to deal with.
What follows should be prefaced with some simile. The simile of a powder mine, a thunderbolt, an earthquake, for it blew Philip up in the air and flattened him on the ground and swallowed him up in the depths.
Bully? Insolent boy? Who's that, I pray, but you? I thank you to leave me alone. I'll thank your mother, too. For 12 years you've trained me and tortured me, and I'll stand it no more. Thank goodness I can stand up against the world now, for I've found Gino, and this time I marry for love.
Yes, and I forbid you to do it. I shall shrink from nothing, for my blood is up. It is unwise of you to laugh. I shall tell him now.
Do! Tell him so now. Have it out with him. Gino! Gino, come in. Avanti! Fra Filippo forbids the banns.
Gino appeared so quickly that he must have been listening outside the door.
Fra Filippo's blood's up. He shrinks from nothing. Oh, take care he doesn't hurt you.
Did she intend them to fight? Philip had no intention of doing so, and no more, it seemed, had Gino, who stood nervously in the middle of the room.
Please, sit down, Signor Corella. Mrs. Herriton is rather agitated, but there is no reason we should not be calm. Might I offer you a cigarette?
He refused the cigarette and the chair. For a long time, Philip was silent. It might impress Gino, and it also gave him time to collect himself. He would make his power felt by restraint. Why, when he looked up to begin, was Gino convulsed with silent laughter?
Signor Corella, I have come to prevent you marrying Mrs. Herriton because I see you will both be unhappy together. She is English. You are Italian. She is accustomed to one thing, you to another, and, pardon me if I say it, she is rich and you are poor. If you grant my request, you will earn our thanks, and you will not be without a reward for your disappointment. What about 1,000 lira?
It is too late.
But why?
Because...
Philip watched his face quiver and reform and dissolve from emotion into emotion. There was avarice at one moment, and insolence, and politeness, and stupidity, and cunning, and let us hope that sometimes there was love. But gradually one emotion dominated, the most unexpected of all, for his chest began to heave, and his mouth to twitch, and suddenly he roared forth his whole being in one tremendous laugh. Philip sprang up, and Gino, who had flung wide his arms to let the glorious creature go, took him by the shoulders and shook him.
Because we are married. Married. Married as soon as I knew you were coming. Oh, and you have come all the way for nothing. Oh, and all your generosity.
Here he saw Philip's face, and it was too much for him. He gasped and exploded and crammed his hands into his mouth and spat them out in another explosion and gave Philip an aimless push which toppled him onto the bed. He uttered a horrified, "Oh!" then bolted away down the passage, shrieking like a child, to tell the joke to his wife. For a time, Philip lay on the bed, pretending to himself that he was hurt grievously. He could scarcely see for temper, and in the passage he ran against Miss Abbott, who promptly burst into tears.
Oh, I start for Sawston tomorrow morning early. He has assaulted me. I could prosecute him, but shall not.
I can't stop here. I can't stop here. You will have to take me with you.
Opposite the Volterra Gate of Monteriano, outside the city, is a very respectable whitewashed mud wall, with a coping of red crinkled tiles to keep it from dissolution. It would suggest a gentleman's garden if there was not in its middle a large hole, which grows larger with every rainstorm. Through the hole is visible another wall, stone this time, which has a wooden door in the middle and two wooden shuttered windows each side, and apparently forms the facade of a one-story house. This house is bigger than it looks, for it slides for two stories down the hill behind, and the wooden door, which is always locked, really leads into the attic. The ground floor and the upper floor of that battered house are alike deserted, and the inmates keep to the central portion, just as in a dying body all the life retires to the heart. There are several rooms, some dark and mostly stuffy, and last but not least, the lodger, where you can live day and night if you feel inclined, drinking vermouth and smoking cigarettes, with leagues of olive trees and vineyards and blue-green hills to watch you. It was in this house that the brief and inevitable tragedy of Lilia's married life took place. She made Gino buy it for her, because it was there she had first seen him, sitting on the mud wall that faced the Volterra Gate. She remembered how the evening sun had struck his hair, and how he had smiled down at her, and being both sentimental and unrefined, was determined to have the man and the place together. Lilia enjoyed settling into the house, with nothing to do except give orders to smiling workpeople and a devoted husband as interpreter. She wrote a jaunty account of her happiness to Mrs. Herriton, and Harriet answered the letter, saying, 1, that all future communications should be addressed to the solicitors, and 2, would Lilia return an inlaid box which Harriet had lent her, lent, not given, to keep handkerchiefs and collars in.
Look what I'm giving up to live with you,
she said to Gino, never unwilling to lay stress on her condescension. He took her to mean the inlaid box, and said that she need not give it up at all.
Oh, silly fellow, no, I mean the life. Those Herritons lead Sawston society. Now, what do I care, so long as I have my silly fellow?
I can tell you!
She always treated him as a boy, which he was, and as a fool, which he was not, thinking herself so immeasurably superior to him that she neglected opportunity after opportunity of establishing her rule. He was passionately in love with her, therefore she could do exactly as she liked.
It mayn't be heaven below,
but it's better than Charles. And all the time the boy was watching her and growing up. She was reminded of Charles by a disagreeable letter from the solicitors, bidding her disgorge a large sum of money for Irma, in accordance with her late husband's will. It was just like Charles's suspicious nature to have provided against a second marriage. Gina was equally indignant, and between them they composed a stinging reply which had no effect. He then said that Irma had better come out and live with them. But Lilia had not the courage even to suggest this to the Herritons, and an unexpected terror seized her at the thought of Irma, or any English child, being educated at Monteriano. Gino became terribly depressed over the solicitor's letter, more depressed than she thought necessary. There was no more to do in the house, and he spent whole days in the lodger, leaning over the parapet or sitting astride it disconsolately.
Hector!
Oh, you idle boy. Go and play Pallone.
I'm a married man. I do not play games anymore.
Go and see your friends, then.
I have no friends now.
Oh, silly, silly, silly. You can't stop indoors all day.
I want to see no one but you.
Oh, no, Gino, don't be silly. Go and see your friends and bring them to see me. We both of us like society.
He went out, found that he was not as friendless as he supposed, and returned after several hours in altered spirits. Lilia congratulated herself on her good management.
I'm ready, too, for people now. I mean, to wake you all up, just as I woke up Sawston. Let's have plenty of men, and make them bring their women kind. I mean, to have real English tea parties. Your friends have wives and sisters, haven't they?
Well, yes, but of course, I scarcely know them.
Not know your friends' people?
I know.
How funny. Well, who are the principal people here? Would it make it easier if I called all around? Isn't that your foreign way?
He did not think it would make it easier.
But I must know someone. Who were the men you were talking to this afternoon?
Low-class men. He could scarcely recollect their names.
Oh, but Gino, dear, if they're low-class, why did you talk to them? Don't you care about your position?
All Gino cared about at present was idleness and pocket money. In his funny, abrupt way, he ran out onto the loggia, where he lay full length on the parapet, and began to smoke and spit under the silence of the stars. Italy is such a delightful place to live in, if you happen to be a man. There one may enjoy that exquisite luxury of socialism, that true socialism that is based not on income or character, but on the equality of manners. In the democracy of the cafe or the street, the brotherhood of man is a reality. But it is accomplished at the expense of the sisterhood of women. Why should you not make friends with your neighbour at the theatre or on the train when you know that feminine prejudice will never come between you? You need never enter his home, nor he yours. Meanwhile, the women have, of course, their house and their church, with its admirable and frequent services. Otherwise, they do not go out much. Occasionally, you will take them to the cafe or the theatre, and immediately all your wonted acquaintance there desert you. It is all very sad, but one consolation emerges. Life is very pleasant in Italy, if you are a man. Hitherto, Gino had not interfered with Lilia. She was so much older than he was, and so much richer, that he regarded her as a superior being who answered to other laws. He was not wholly surprised, for strange rumours were always blowing over the Alps, of lands where men and women had the same amusements and interests, and he had often met that privileged maniac, the lady tourist, on her solitary walks. Lilia took solitary walks, too, and only that week a tramp had grabbed at her watch, an episode which is supposed to be indigenous in Italy, though is really less frequent there than in Bond Street. Now that he knew her better, he was inevitably losing his awe. No one could live with her and keep it, especially when she had been so silly as to lose a gold watch and chain. As he lay thoughtful along the parapet, he realized for the first time the responsibilities of married life. He must save her from dangers, physical and social, for after all she was a woman.
And I?
He reflected.
Am at all events a man. And know what is right.
He found her still in the living room, combing her hair.
You must not go out alone. It is not safe.
If you want to walk, Perfetta shall accompany you.
Perfetta was a widowed cousin who was living with them as factotum.
Very well,
smiled Lilia, as if she were addressing a solicitor's kitten. But for all that, she never took a solitary walk again, with one exception, till the day of her death. Days passed, and no one called except poor relatives. She began to feel dull. Didn't he know the syndico or the bank manager? Even the landlady of the Stella d'Italia would be better than no one. When she went into town, she was pleasantly received. But people naturally found a difficulty in getting on with a lady who could not learn their language. And the tea party, under Gino's adroit management, receded ever and ever before her. He had a good deal of anxiety over her welfare, for she did not settle down in the house at all. But he was comforted by a welcome and unexpected visitor. As he was going one afternoon for the letters, someone humorously threw a cloak over his head, and when he disengaged himself, he saw his very dear friend Spiridione Tesi of the Custom House at Chiasso, whom he had not met for 2 years. What joy! What salutations! So that all the passers-by smiled with approval on the amiable scene.
Oh, an English wife is very good indeed, and she's rich?
Oh, immensely rich.
Blonde or dark?
Blonde.
No! Is it possible?
There were no letters, and of course they sat down at the Café Garibaldi. Quite a good café, that, for so small a city. There were marble-topped tables and pillars, terracotta below and gold above, and on the ceiling was a fresco of the Battle of Solferino. They had vermouth and little cakes with sugar on top, which they chose gravely at the counter, pinching them first to be sure they were fresh.
Tell me,
said Spiridione.
I forgot to ask, is she young?
33.
Ah, well, we cannot have everything. Is she simpatica?
It's sufficiently so.
Well, it is a most important thing. The person who understands us at first sight, who never irritates us, who never bores, to whom we can pour forth every thought and wish, not only in speech, but in silence. That is what I mean by simpatica.
Ah, yeah. There are such men, I know, but where will you find such a woman?
Oh, that is true. Sono poco simpatiche le donne. And the time we waste over them is much.
One I have seen who may be so. She too was English. The companion of my wife.
Mm.
But Fra Filippo, the brother-in-law, took her back with him.
Oh.
Gino spoke of his exciting and secret marriage, and they made fun of the unfortunate Philip, who had travelled over Europe to stop it.
I regret, though, that I toppled him onto the bed.
No!
A great tall man. When I am really amused, I am often impolite.
You will never see him again. And by now this scene will have passed from his mind.
It sometimes happens that such things are recollected longest.
The shadows of the terracotta pillars lengthened, and tourists flying through the Palazzo Pubblico opposite could observe how the Italians wasted time. The sight of tourists reminded Gino of something he might say.
I want to consult you, since you are so kind as to take an interest in my affairs. My wife wishes to take solitary walks.
But no.
But I have forbidden her.
Naturally.
She does not understand. She asks me to accompany her sometimes, to walk without object, you know. She would like me to be with her all day.
She needs employment. Is she a Catholic?
No.
Well, that is a pity. She must be persuaded. It will be a great solace to her when she is alone.
But I am a Catholic too, but of course I never go to church.
Yeah, of course not. Still, you might take her at first.
She wishes to give tea parties. Men and women together. What am I to do about it?
Do nothing. Or ask me.
Come. She will be quite pleased.
Of course, I was only joking.
Oh, yeah. Come on.
Waiter!
Lilia was delighted to see them, and became more animated than Gino had known her for a long time. Spiridione's manners were very agreeable. He kissed her hand on introduction, and as his profession had taught him a little English, conversation did not flag.
Do you like music?
Personally, I have not studied scientific music, but the music of the heart, yes.
So she played on the humming piano very badly, and he sang not so badly. Gino got out a guitar and sang, too, sitting out on the loggia. It was a most agreeable visit. Gino said he would just walk his friend back to his lodgings. As they went, he said, without the least trace of malice or satire in his voice,
I think you are quite right. I shall not bring people to the house anymore. I do not see why an English wife should be treated differently. This is Italy.
They had reached the lodging, but went as far as the Café Garibaldi, where they spent a long and most delightful evening. The advance of regret can be so gradual that it is impossible to say, yesterday I was happy, today I am not. At no one moment did Lilia realize that her marriage was a failure, yet during the summer and autumn she became as unhappy as it was possible for her nature to be. She had no unkind treatment, and few unkind words from her husband. He simply left her alone. In the morning he went out to do business, which, as far as she could discover, meant sitting in the farmacia. He usually returned to lunch, after which he retired to another room and slept. In the evening he grew vigorous again and took the air on the ramparts, often having his dinner out and seldom returning till midnight or later. She began to see that she must assert herself, but she could not see how. Her self-confidence, which had overthrown Philip, had gradually oozed away. Night after night did Lilia curse Miss Abbott, her false friend, who had agreed with her that the marriage would do, and then, at the first hint of opposition, had fled back to England, shrieking and distraught. Miss Abbott headed the long list of those who should never be written to, and who would never be forgiven. Almost the only person who was not on that list was Mr. Kingcroft, who had unexpectedly sent an affectionate and inquiring letter. At first she had seen a few English people, for Monteriano was not the end of the earth. One or two inquisitive ladies, who had heard at home of her quarrel with the Herritons, came to call. She was very sprightly, and they thought her quite unconventional, and Gino a charming boy, so all that was to the good. But by May the season, such as it was, had finished, and there would be no one till next spring. As Mrs. Herriton had often observed, Lilia had no resources. She did not like music, or reading, or work. Her one qualification for life was rather blousy high spirits. She was not obedient, but she was cowardly. And in the most gentle way, which Mrs. Herriton might have envied, Gino made her do what he wanted. At first it had been rather fun to let him get the upper hand, but it was galling to discover that he could not do otherwise. There was plenty of brutality deep down in him, and one day Lilia nearly touched it. It was the old question of going out alone.
I always do it in England.
This is Italy.
Yes, but I'm older than you, and I'll settle.
I am your husband.
And I've got the money.
He looked horrified.
Falsita!
Now was the moment to assert herself.
I've got the money. And you'd better mend your manners, for you'd find it awkward if I stopped drawing checks.
She was no reader of character, but she quickly became alarmed. As she said to Perfetta afterwards, none of his clothes seemed to fit. Too big in one place, too small in another. He edged round the table to where she was sitting, and she sprang away and held the chair between them, too frightened to speak or move. He looked at her with round, expressionless eyes, and slowly stretched out his left hand. Perfetta was heard coming up from the kitchen. It seemed to wake him up, and he turned away and went to his room without a word. Perfetta heard the account and crossed herself. Lilia crossed herself also. Thus did the two women pay homage to their outraged male. It was clear to Lilia at last that Gino had married her for money. But he had frightened her too much to leave any place for contempt. His return was terrifying, for he was frightened too, imploring her pardon, lying at her feet, embracing her, striving to define things which he did not understand. But for all his suffering, he had tamed her, and she never threatened to cut off supplies again. It would have been well if he had been as strict over his own behaviour as he was over hers, but the incongruity never occurred to him for a moment. The discovery of his infidelity, which she made by accident, destroyed such remnants of self-satisfaction as her life might yet possess. She broke down utterly and sobbed and cried in Perfetta's arms. Perfetta was kind, but cautioned her on no account to speak to Gino, who would be furious if he was suspected.
Perhaps if I had a child, he would be different. I know he wants a son.
Lilia had achieved pathos despite herself, for there are some situations in which vulgarity counts no longer. Not Cordelia nor Imogen more deserve our tears. One evening, when he had gone out, Lilia could stand it no longer. It was September. Sawston would be just filling up after the summer holidays. People would be running in and out of each other's houses all along the road. There were bicycle gymkhanas, and on the 30th, Mrs. Herriton would be holding the annual bazaar in the garden for the Church Missionary Society. It seemed impossible that such a free, happy life could exist. She walked out onto the loggia. Moonlight and stars in a soft purple sky. The walls of Monteriano should be glorious on such a night as this, but the house faced away from them. Perfetta was in the kitchen, and the stairs down led past the kitchen door, but the stairs up. By unlocking the door at the top, one might slip out onto the terrace above the house, and thus, for 10 minutes, walk in freedom and peace. The key was in the pocket of Gino's best suit, the English check, which he never wore. The walls were beautiful, but they were in shadow. She looked anxiously at the house and started. The few people she met wished her a civil good night, taking her in her hatless condition for a peasant. The walls trended round towards the moon, and presently she came into its light and saw all the rough towers turn into pillars of silver and black, and the ramparts into cliffs of pearl. Lilia began to cry, for here, where a great cypress interrupted the monotony of the girdle of olives, she had sat with Gino one afternoon in March, her head upon his shoulder, while Caroline was looking at the view and sketching. Round the corner was the Siena Gate, from which the road to England started, and she could hear the rumble of the diligence which was going down to catch the night train to Empoli. The next moment it was upon her, for the high road came towards her before it began its long zigzag down the hill. The driver slackened and called to her to get in. He did not know who she was. He hoped she might be coming to the station.
Non vengo.
He wished her good night and turned his horses. As the diligence came past, she saw that it was empty.
Vengo.
Her voice was tremulous and did not carry.
Vengo, vengo!
She ran down the road, screaming for him to stop. If he would but turn for an instant, she would be saved. She tried to cut off the corner of the zigzag, stumbling over the great clods of earth which lay between the eternal olives. She was far too late, for just before she regained the road, the thing swept past her, thunderous, ploughing up choking clouds of moonlit dust. She did not call any more, for she felt very ill and fainted. And when she revived, she was lying in the road with dust in her eyes, and dust in her mouth, and dust down her ears. There is something very terrible in dust at night time. Ill luck pursued her to the end. It was one of the nights when Gino happened to come in. He was in the kitchen, swearing and smashing plates, while Perfetta, her apron over her head, was weeping violently. At the sight of Lilia, he poured forth a flood of miscellaneous abuse. He was far more angry, but much less alarming, than he had been that day when he edged after her round the table. And Lilia gained more courage from her bad conscience than she ever had from her good one, for as he spoke, she was seized with indignation and feared him no longer, and saw him for a cruel, worthless, hypocritical, dissolute upstart, and spoke in return. Perfetta screamed, for she told him everything, all she knew and all she thought. He stood with open mouth, all the anger gone out of him, feeling ashamed and an utter fool. He was rightfully cornered. Then, alas, the absurdity of his own position grew upon him, and he laughed, as he would have laughed at the same situation on the stage.
I am tricked! I am conquered! I give in. Let us talk of it no more.
Neither Perfetta, nor Gino, nor Lilia herself knew the true reason of all the misery that followed. To the end, he thought that kindness and a little attention would be enough to set things straight. No one realized that the struggle was national, that generations of ancestors, good, bad, or indifferent, forbade the Latin man to be chivalrous to the northern woman to forgive the Latin man. All this might have been foreseen. Mrs. Herriton foresaw it from the first. The night he laughed at her, Lilia wildly took up paper and pen and wrote page after page, enumerating his iniquities, tracing all the causes and the growth of her misery. It was not till its conclusion did she realize for whom it was meant.
Irma, darling Irma, this letter is for you. I almost forget I have a daughter. It will make you unhappy, but I want you to know everything, and you cannot learn things too soon. God bless you, my dearest, and save you. God bless your miserable mother.
Fortunately, Mrs. Herriton was in when the letter arrived. She seized it and opened it in her bedroom. Another moment, and Irma's placid childhood would have been destroyed forever. Lilia received a brief note from Harriet, again forbidding direct communication between mother and daughter, and concluding with formal condolences. It nearly drove her mad. They were on the lodger when the letter arrived. He often sat with her now, watching her for hours, puzzled and anxious, but not contrite.
Lilia?
It's nothing.
She went in and began to write, a very short letter, whose gist was, "Come and save me." It is not good to see your wife crying when she writes, especially if you are conscious that, on the whole, your treatment of her has been reasonable and kind. It is not good, when you accidentally look over her shoulder, to see that she is writing to a man. Nor should she shake her fist at you when she leaves the room, under the impression that you are engaged in lighting a cigar and cannot see her. Lilia went to the post herself. But in Italy so many things can be arranged. The postman was a friend of Gino's, and Mr. Kingcroft never got his letter. So she gave up hope, became ill, and all through the autumn lay in bed. Gino was distracted. She knew why. He wanted a son. His one desire was to become the father of a man like himself. Before the child was born, he gave her a kiss and said,
"I have prayed all night for a boy."
Some strangely tender impulse moved her, and she said faintly,
"You are a boy yourself, Gino."
"Then we shall be brothers."
He lay outside the room, with his head against the door like a dog. When they came to tell him the glad news, they found him half unconscious, and his face was wet with tears. As for Lilia, someone said to her, "It is a beautiful boy." But she had died in giving birth to him. At the time of Lilia's death, Philip Herriton was just 24 years of age. Indeed, the news reached Sawston on his birthday.
"Are we to go into mourning, do you think?"
Mrs. Herriton always asked her children's advice where possible. Harriet thought that they should. She had been detestable to Lilia while she lived, but she always felt that the dead deserve attention and sympathy.
"But it will mean telling Irma."
"Of course we must tell Irma."
"Of course.
But I think we can still not tell her about Lilia's marriage.
Would you forget this wretched baby? Waters and Adamson write that there is a baby.
This baby's quite beside the point. Mrs. Theobald will do nothing, and it's no concern of ours.
Well, it'll make a difference in the money, surely.
No, dear, very little. Poor Charles provided for every kind of contingency in his will. The money will come to you and Harriet as Irma's guardians.
Good. So if those are our tactics, to tell no one about the baby, not even Miss Abbott?
And why ever should we tell Caroline, poor silly creature? She burst into tears when I told her a little, only a little, of that terrible letter. We must forgive her and forget. Let the dead bury their dead.
Here beginneth the new life, then. Do you remember, Mother, that's what we said when we saw Lilia off?
Yes, dear. But now it is really a new life, because we are all at accord. Then you were still infatuated with Italy. It may be full of beautiful pictures and churches, but we cannot judge a country by anything but its men.
That is quite true,
he said sadly. And as the tactics were now settled, Philip went out and took an aimless and solitary walk. By the time he came back, Irma had been told of her mother's death, and Miss Abbott had been told also. Irma had wept loudly. Fortunately, the school prize-giving was at hand, and that, together with the prospect of new black clothes, kept her from meditating on the fact that Lilia, who had been absent so long, would now be absent forever.
As for Caroline, I was almost frightened. She broke down utterly.
Did she ask no questions? As to the nature of Lilia's death, I mean.
She did. But she saw that I was reticent, and she did not press me. You see, Philip, I can say to you what I could not say before Harriet. Her ideas are so crude. Really, we do not want it known in Sawston that there is a baby. All peace and comfort would be lost if people came inquiring after it.
Philip agreed enthusiastically, and a few days later, when he chanced to travel up to London with Miss Abbott, he had all the time the pleasant thrill of one who is better informed. Their last journey together had been from Monteriano back across Europe. It had been ghastly, and Philip, from the force of association, rather expected something ghastly now. He was surprised. Miss Abbott, between Sawston and Charing Cross, revealed qualities which he had never guessed her to possess. At first, she annoyed him. They were talking, of course, about Lilia.
You never really knew how much I was to blame.
Never mind. It's all over now.
The first evening we got to Monteriano, Lilia went for a walk alone, saw that Italian in a picturesque position on a wall, and fell in love. He was shabbily dressed, and she did not even know he was the son of a dentist. I must tell you, I was used to this sort of thing. Once or twice before, I'd had to send people about their business.
Yes, we counted on you.
I know you did. Lilia saw him several times again, and I knew I ought to interfere. I called her to my bedroom one night. She was very frightened, for she knew how severe I could be. Do you love this man? I asked. Yes or no? She said yes. And I said, why don't you marry him if you think he'll be happy? Next morning I found Signor Corella and said the same to him. He, well, he was willing. That's all.
Really? And the telegram?
That was wrong. I came to the station meaning to tell you everything then. But I got frightened. And at the end, when you left, I got frightened again and came with you.
Well, did you really mean to stop?
For a time, at all events.
Would that have suited a newly married pair?
It would have suited them. Lilia needed me. And as for him, I can't help feeling I might have got influence over him.
But pardon me, Miss Abbott. Of most of your conduct, you have given a description rather than an explanation.
An explanation may bore you, Mr. Harrington. It drags in other topics. I hated Sawston, you see.
So did, and do, I. That's splendid. Go on.
I hated the idleness, the stupidity, the respectability, the petty unselfishness.
Petty selfishness?
Petty unselfishness. I had got an idea that everyone here spent their lives in making little sacrifices for objects they didn't care for, to please people they didn't love, that they never learned how to be sincere, and, what's as bad, never learned how to enjoy themselves. That's what I thought. What I thought at Monteriano.
Why, Miss Abbott? You should have told me this before. I agree with lots of it. Magnificent.
Now, Lilia, though there were things about her I didn't like, had somehow kept the power of enjoying herself with sincerity. And Gino, I thought, was splendid and young and sincere as the day. If they wanted to marry, why shouldn't they do so? Why shouldn't she break with the deadening groove? Of course I was wrong. I can never trust myself to judge character again.
Did you never think of the disparity of their social position?
We were mad. Drunk with rebellion. We had no common sense. As soon as you came, you saw and foresaw everything.
Oh, I don't think that.
Philip was vaguely displeased at being credited with common sense.
You see, Mr. Harrington, it makes me specially unhappy. It's the only time I've ever gone into real life. Look what I've made of it. I seem to be waking up to beauty and splendor. I wanted to fight against mediocrity and spitefulness and society. I didn't see that they are invincible, and that if we go against them, they will break us to pieces.
The train reached Charing Cross, and they parted. He to go to a matinee, she to buy petticoats for the corpulent poor. These events and conversations took place at Christmas time. The new life initiated by them lasted some 7 months. Then a little incident, a mere little vexatious incident, brought it to its close. Irma collected picture postcards, and Mrs. Herriton or Harriet always glanced first at all that came, lest the child should get hold of something vulgar. On this occasion the subject seemed perfectly inoffensive, a lot of ruined factory chimneys. And Harriet was about to hand it to her niece when her eye was caught by the words on the margin. She gave a shriek and flung the card into the grate. Of course, no fire was alight in July, and Irma only had to run and pick it out again.
How dare you!
Screamed her aunt.
You wicked girl! Give it here!
Unfortunately, Mrs. Herriton was out of the room. Irma, who was not in awe of Harriet, danced around the table, reading as she did so.
View of the superb city of Monteriano. From your little brother.
Stupid Harriet caught her, boxed her ears, and tore her postcard into fragments. Irma howled and began shouting indignantly.
Who is my little brother? Why have I never heard of him before? Grandmama? Grandmama! Who is my little brother?
Mrs. Herriton swept into the room, saying,
Come with me, dear, and I will tell you. Now it is time for you to know.
Irma returned from the interview sobbing. Though, as a matter of fact, she had learned very little. But she had promised secrecy. She knew not why. Mrs. Herriton made it easy for her daughter to go for 6 weeks to the Tyrol. Then, just as she and Philip had got things a little quiet, the beastly baby sent another picture postcard. A comic one, not particularly proper. Irma received it while they were out, and all the trouble began again.
Do you suppose that he guesses the situation? How anxious we are to hush the scandal up. Perhaps he hopes that we shall adopt it, to quiet Irma.
Hopeful indeed.
Who's to watch her at school? She may bubble out at any moment.
Irma did bubble out that very day. She was proof against a single postcard, not against two. A new little brother is a valuable sentimental asset to a schoolgirl. She had promised not to tell. She knew not why. And she told. And one girl told another, and one girl told her mother, and the thing was out. It was several days before they saw Miss Abbott. She sat tight in her chair, looking graver and more wooden than ever.
I dare say you have heard.
Yes, I have. I came to ask you, have any steps been taken?
About the baby?
Yes.
As far as I know, no steps. Mrs. Theobald may have decided on something, but I have not heard of it.
But does not Mrs. Theobald always take any initiative from you?
The child is no relation of ours. It is, therefore, scarcely for us to interfere.
Then is nothing to be done for the child at all?
It's extraordinarily good of you to take this unexpected interest.
The child came into the world through my negligence. It is natural I should take an interest in it.
My dear Caroline, you must not brood over the thing. The child should worry you even less than it worries us. We never even mention it. It belongs to another world.
Please would you let me know if Mrs. Theobald decides on anything? I should like to join as well and share in any possible expenses.
Oh, my dear, how you throw about your money. We would never allow it.
And if she decides on nothing, please also let me know. Let me know in any case.
Is the young person mad?
Burst out Philip as soon as she had departed. His mother said nothing.
Never in my life have I seen such colossal impertinence. She ought to be well smacked and sent back to Sunday school.
Yet ought the child to grow up in that place and with that father?
What are you up to, Mother?
Up to? I am wondering whether I ought not to adopt the child. Is that sufficiently plain? If I can rescue poor Lilia's baby from that horrible man, I shall do it.
Mrs. Herriton wrote a letter for Waters and Adamson to send to Gino. Gino replied. He could not accept the generous offer. As for the picture postcards, it displeased him greatly that they had been obnoxious. He would send no more.
I must go and tell poor Caroline. She will be equally distressed.
Mrs. Herriton returned from the visit in the most extraordinary condition. Her face was red. She panted for breath.
The impudence! The cursed impudence! Oh, I'm swearing I don't care, that beastly woman! How dare she interfere? I'll... Oh, Philip, dear, I'm sorry. It's no good. You must go.
Go where?
She won't accept the letter as final. You must go to Monteriano.
I won't. I've been and I've failed. I'll never see the place again. I hate Italy.
If you don't go, she will.
Abbott?
Yes. Going alone would start this evening. The child, if you please, Irma's brother, to live with her, to be brought up by her and her father at our very gates, to go to school like a gentleman, she paying. Oh, you're a man. It doesn't matter for you. You can laugh. But I know what people say. And that woman goes to Italy this evening.
Well, then let her go. She'll come to Greece somehow. Italy's too dangerous, too...
Stop that nonsense, Philip. I will not be disgraced by her. I will have the child. Pay all we've got for it. I will have it. Harriet shall go, too.
And before Philip had stopped talking nonsense, she had planned the whole thing and was looking out the trains.
Quella per me pari sono a quant'altre d'intorno.